So good morning. I'm seeing people from all over, from the region and far beyond. From the local to the international, which is quite marvelous. We hear so much about risk these days. Probably each of you has had a thought. Oh, I'm pausing because I see someone joining. Well, I'm hoping she's on. We hear so much about risk these days, and probably each one of you has had some thought about risk in the past day or week, because the landscape of risk keeps shifting, and so you have to keep kind of assessing, and no one person's assessment of risk is the same as anyone else's. Here are just a few headlines from a quick scan of the New York Times. Going back to work means taking a calculated risk. What's the risk of catching COVID from a surface? And this one, a Canadian issue that made the Times. Risking their lives in Canada's pandemic and hoping that's enough to stay. The article is about refugee claimants working as caregivers in Quebec nursing homes for low pay and often unsafe working conditions. Many of these workers are Black Haitians who fled the U.S. Under the Trump administration in the last several years, made their way to Canada. The article interviewed a couple of them who had one, a young single mother who had caught the virus and transmitted it to her child. And they both have survived. And yet, you know, for folks living so close to the edge, you know, what is that like? According to official sources, those of us who are at the greatest risk of severe COVID-19 infection are people who are over 65, even more so those who are over 85, and those who have heart, lung, or immune compromise conditions. We've all heard this. New medical information emerges each week. According to one new study, having type A blood was linked to a 50% increase in the likelihood that a patient would need to get oxygen or go on a ventilator. But these lists and these medically funded, these funded medical studies don't include factors like poverty, access to health care, living or working in high density conditions. The healthcare workers and first responders, the meatpacking plant workers, the agricultural workers, the transportation workers who cannot comfortably shelter in place and work from home, those who are incarcerated, who are unable to socially distance, physically distance. So many other factors that increase the risk. We know that in the States, the burden of illness and death from COVID-19 has fallen disproportionately upon the Black, Latino, and Native populations. Not because the virus discriminates, but because our society does. We know that Black and Indigenous people are more at risk of police violence. There are statistics to show us and video evidence. We know who is more risk at risk of domestic violence? Women. We know who is more at risk of incarceration. Blacks and other minorities. In Canada, Indigenous people, very disproportionately represented in our prison population. Life can be a risky proposition, and clearly more so for some than others. But ultimately, none of us gets out of here alive, right? So how do we negotiate? How do we negotiate our personal assessments of risk while taking due consideration for the risk levels of others that might be different from ours? Some of you might remember, it's been a while. Last year I gave a Dharma talk on a book called The Power of Gentleness, A Meditation on the Risk of Living, by a French philosopher and psychoanalyst named Anne Dufour-Mantel. And in that book, she didn't really talk that much. She talked about the power of gentleness, this concept, but she didn't really talk that much about the risk of living. I think that that was a choice by the English translator or publisher to add that subtitle in light of her further work, her later work. But at the time, that topic, the question of risk, piqued my interest. So I wanted to read her more recent book, which is called, here it is, In Praise of Risk. See the guy on the cover? That's that guy who walked on a high line between the World Trade Towers years ago. That's the photo. Talk about risk. So I read this, her more recent book, a few months ago with the intention of working it into a Dharma talk, and then the pandemic happened. So in light of these recent events, you might wonder why we'd want to talk about or consider praising risk. Is she going to recommend that we recklessly up the ante on our risk-taking behavior? Before I talk about Dufour-Mantel's perspective, I first want to talk about risk-taking from the perspective of developmental psychology. And don't worry, I will bring it all around to Zen practice. I'll try. Our personality is made up of temperament and character. Temperament refers to the characteristics we are more or less born with that have a degree of stability throughout life. And character is what develops throughout our lifetime through learning and absorbing values and attitudes. Or through our interaction with the world, with our environment. However, temperament, as I said, what we're more or less born with, is not set in stone. The characteristics of temperament have a range of expression, and they're influenced by environmental factors through our lives. And they are observed with most, you know, by those who study these things, they are observed with most consistency in early childhood, and they become less consistent as we grow older. Which is kind of a good thing. I mean, it's a good and bad thing. It means it can be modified by trauma, but also by growth and maturing. So that, for example, someone who is on the introverted, so one scale is introversion, extroversion, right? How socially outgoing we are. So someone on the introverted end of the scale is not likely to be transformed either suddenly or gradually to someone on the far other end of the scale. But what they can do, what any of us can do, is widen our range and become more confident and accepting of our particular configuration of temperament and person and who, so that we don't identify with those labels in a fixed way. And this is what we do in our practice as well. You know, we let go of the identifiers that affirm who we think we are. So I'm refraining from referring to these characteristics of temperament as biologically determined, as is often done, because I think neuroscience and molecular biology and developmental psychology are only beginning to understand just how complex these relationships are, and how intergenerational trauma is expressed in the interaction between genetics and environment. So I think we have to be really careful about using these models in a sort of reductionist or oversimplified way. There have been various models of temperament constructed and put forward, and they have many points of similarity, but no single one has been generally adopted. That's how it is in the academic world. They tend to list various scales, such as sensitivity to sensory stimuli, right? Some people are very sensitive to sensory input, and others have high tolerance. Or attention span, short or long. Or initial reaction to new people or situations. Approach or withdrawal. Where are you on each of those scales? That's what we're looking at. And little children tend to be fairly consistent. One scale that's associated with risk-taking is called sensation-seeking. So on one end would be the person who loves those high-risk sports. What are they called? There's another word for them. High-risk, you know, bungee jumping off cliffs and that kind of thing. Or rock climbing without ropes. And then on the other end of the scale are those of us who think life is quite scary enough, thank you very much, and play it pretty safe, or as safely as possible. And on the far end would be someone who's afraid to leave the house, right? Another scale is adaptability to novelty. Novelty, unpredictability, or uncertainty. You know, some people feel novelty, unpredictability, and uncertainty are destabilizing, scary, threatening, and others seek novelty. So there's another scale, right? So my point in bringing up temperament is to help us bring awareness to our own propensities, to individual differences, so we can be more mindful of ourselves and others as we negotiate a collective strategy for risk assessment and action as these COVID restrictions lift, right? So we can be patient with ourselves and others, so we can find common ground rather than taking adversarial stances. And sometimes that might mean that we shift our own ground out of care for someone else. And sometimes that might mean that we have to stand our own ground and ask someone else to respect our point of view. You know, there's no easy formula here. Okay, so now going back to the book, In Praise of Risk. It was first published in French in 2011 as Éloge du Risque, and then in 2017, the author, Dufour Montel, died trying to save two children caught in the rough seas at a Mediterranean beach. She was only 53. The two children were rescued, but she drowned. And newspapers all over the world reported this tragedy and put particular emphasis on her work. The New York Times went so far as to say she died as a result of following her own bold philosophy. Her translator, Stephen Miller, in his introduction says very clearly that the press, probably without even reading her work, assumed the very paradigm that she wanted to deconstruct. It made a sensational story, and a wrenching, heart-wrenching story. Miller, the translator, says, risk is never neutral. It is always an object of praise or blame, an occasion for celebration or lamentation. So as you know, I think, then in Buddhist thought, praise and blame are two of the eight worldly winds that blow us around all the time, as we try to seek one and avoid the other, right? Pleasure and pain, praise and blame, fame and disrepute, and I'm blanking the fourth pair, but you've heard these, and these are the worldly winds, the worldly dharmas that we're always being pushed and pulled between. What if we were to cultivate a mind that was not so easily swayed? The capacity to set our course and then make adjustments according to conditions. This is the capacity, this is the spaciousness, the flexibility with which Dufour Mantel proposes we meet the risk of living. Not with reckless abandon. Her first chapter is to risk one's life. And her first sentence is, life is a heedless risk taken by us, the living. She says, to risk one's life is among the most beautiful expressions in our language. Does it mean to confront death and to survive? How is it possible as a living being to think risk in terms of life rather than death? To risk one's life is first, perhaps, not dying. So she's proposing that to risk one's life is to live fully. She says, risk opens an unknown space. As an act, risk lets chance take hold. The instant of decision, the one in which a risk is taken, inaugurates an other time, much as trauma does, but a positive trauma. So that's a little puzzling. What she's saying here that is in contrast to what we think of as trauma, where our present experience is hijacked by past fear and pain, right? Trauma can do that. It can hijack our present because we flip back into past fear, past pain. But she's saying in this moment of risk, the horizon opens to possibility. So it's rather than a hijacking of the present, it's an opening, freeing of the present. To risk one's life, she is saying, is to live life just as it is, right here, right now. She continues, if risk is the event of not dying, it is beyond choice, a physical engagement at close quarters with the unknown, night, non-knowledge, a wager in the face of what precisely remains undecidable. It thus opens the possibility that something unhoped for will happen. Would it not suffice less dramatically to think, what makes us persevere in being? To think patience instead, this measure of time that, in the face of urgency, cauterizes wounds, the patience of being. Isn't that a beautiful phrase? The patience of being. A subtle, forgotten, uncolonized art of the self in which emotion is entangled with thought, the cuisine of all creation. But it would have to be a patience neither in the service of waiting, nor especially in the service of depression, compromise, or fatal renunciation. This risk, the risk of being, cannot be envisaged or evaluated. The grand machinery of the economy is what promotes the evaluation of risks. We've noticed that, how the grand machinery of the economy is invoked as a way of measuring risk, evaluating risk in these times. She says, sometimes we have mere moments left before it's time, which she means before our time's up, before we die. And in the intensity of what's lived in those moments is an infinite surplus of time, a grace, a mercy. So as you can see, her writing style is dense. It's dense with image and myth, poetic language, as well as philosophical and psychoanalytic language. So it's not a quick and easy read. You have to really go back and read her again and slowly, as though you were reading a dense poem again and again. But in her words, there are passages of pure Dharma, which is why I've been moved to kind of dip into this with you. So I'm going to share a few more excerpts, because sometimes it's good to hear the Dharma in a different language or idiom to kind of shake us up a little. She writes short chapters. They're like meditations on different kinds of risk. Her chapter on risking disobedience is only a page and a half long, but it's packed with subtle insight. She says, the risk of disobeying supposes the capacity to obey something other than the ego, the conscious ego. If our disobedience is only obeying the ego, then, she says, it's mere caprice, bravado, reactivity that we justify after the fact as rational. In other words, not the disobedience of a fully mature human being. So she uses this term, self-obedience, to encompass what she says, the fact that we are not entirely subjective, that the ego is only a part of ourselves, albeit not the part that governs us and founds our identity. But certain experiences do not demand the consent of a subject. They simply happen, and happen to us. That's all. And we happen to be at this specific place for just a moment, just for... just for an event of this world. Self-obedience is to recognize the existence of an inalienable place that the subjective does not entirely contain. So this is a little difficult, I think, just hearing her writing. But she's saying this is the place of the self beyond self. The inalienable place that the subjective does not entirely contain. It's the place of self beyond self that gives us the freedom perhaps even in captivity, to refuse, to disobey. Think of Martin Luther King or Nelson Mandela in prison. There's an inner freedom that refuses, that disobeys, even in incarceration. Or the Tibetan monks and nuns imprisoned by the Chinese. So this is a self, what she's calling this self-obedience that's self beyond self. And I would say this disobedience, this is the disobedience of a bodhisattva, not based on self-clinging, but arising from liberation. And then she talks about the risk of being in suspense. I've often described this time in COVID-19 lockdown or whatever we'll call it, as having a suspended feeling. She says, to be in suspense is to hold your breath. And to look with as much attention as possible at what is simply there, at what offers itself to you in the presence of things. So I think in that first sentence, she's playing on the conventional sense of suspense, right? The suspenseful film, you catch your breath, you hold your breath, where we gasp. But really, for the quality of attention she then describes, to pay as much attention as possible at what is simply there, at what offers itself to you in the presence of things, that requires us to keep breathing. And that's what we do. It's that rather acrobatic skill of being able to pause, not to judge, not to decide, not yet, not right now, to remain as long as possible in this untenable posture that internally commands you to remain at the disposal of, she says, at the disposal of, and not to trust any prefabricated or predigested concept. I think what she means by to remain at the disposal of, because she doesn't give an object of that, to remain at the disposal of, I think what she means is to be ready to respond fully to the particularity of these circumstances. To put ourselves at the disposal of life as it is, not your own agenda or any other. She continues, she says, to remain as far as possible from thinking calcified into postures, responses, and certainties, but still to think. Remember Dogen's words, think not thinking? That's what she's describing. This is what we do in Zazen. To remain as far as possible from thinking calcified into postures, responses, and certainties, but still to think. The mind still flows. She gives a nod to the practice in the Eastern Taoist and Buddhist traditions of not doing, of non-action, which is in no way passive or resigned. The Buddhist image that embodies this quality is Fudomyo. We looked at him when we did our series, Our Field Guide to the Bodhisattvas. Even though he's not a bodhisattva, he's a wondrous king. He's guardian of the Dharma. And his name means, Fudo is unmoving. Myo, a wondrous king. And he has a fierce scowling face with one fang pointing up and one fang pointing down. His skin is often... Oh, here he is. This is a very simple image of him. Doesn't even show his fangs, but he has his sword. His skin is often red or blue. He stands on a craggy rock, symbolizing powerful steadfastness. And often he's surrounded by a ring of flames, depicting not a hell realm, but the elemental energy of fire burning through our delusions. You know, and he's sitting steadfast in a world that's burning. We could also see it that way. He carries that sword in one hand, like Manjushri Bodhisattva, to cut through delusion. And he carries a rope in his other hand to restrain our unruly desires. And his name, Unmoving, doesn't refer to a kind of rigid immobility, but rather a readiness, a dynamic readiness to take action, to respond, to fiercely oppose, to disobey, to cut through, to see the truth of our self-clinging. Duhurmantel says, "We have such a strong desire to recognize ourselves in our acts, our judgments, our assertions," right? This is what I think. "But when we do not succumb to the mirages of intentionality," she says, "when we can disengage from our projections and identifications, or in Buddhist terms, our self-clinging," she says, "in that space of suspension, we're on the threshold of what she calls universality and what in our practice we'd call emptiness or boundlessness, when we can suspend our self-clinging." She says these moments of suspense are like an inner retreat. And she asks, "How can we take the risk of protecting this retreat without haste or violence? To linger there where thinking, which is also to say emotion, moves. Not to destroy anything, to observe, to pacify, to let thinking unfold, extend, and emerge from its errors." Isn't that a great phrase? To let thinking unfold, extend, and emerge from its errors, moving into spaciousness. And she says, then the world gets lighter. So yes, these months of sheltering in place have had a suspended quality, maybe for many of us. Have you felt a space of pause to open the hand of your habitual thought patterns and witness your experience of the world, just as it is? And in doing so, has there been an opening to a more spacious sense of your life? And maybe there are moments of contraction as well. Probably it fluctuates, huh? But a sense of spaciousness, even in the midst of restriction. Wave your hand if you felt some fluctuation between that contraction and expansion. Yeah, I think so. I think this is a really good practice in case we ever end up incarcerated. I think that to myself. Okay, you know, you're getting ready just in case you ever get hauled in. Because that day could come. We might pause to imagine our fellow human beings who are incarcerated in one way or another in conditions that have not supported staying safe and calm and kind in these recent months. Duhurmantel devotes one chapter to a meditation she calls Zero Risk? She begins, "In a society where insurance is imposed on us in every domain because no one is allowed to decline coverage anymore or simply make do without it, it has become useless to promote zero risk because it has become a matter of course. Zero risk has become the obligatory horizon of our collective and individual decisions. A little money is all the insurance industry seems to demand for itself to protect us against the occurrence of any type of accident." What a fantasy, hey? And of course, she's speaking from the perspective of France, probably where there's universal health care and maybe the insurance situation is pretty tight. That's not the case in the States, where the reality of undocumented workers or those who have lost their jobs and had their health care options suddenly drastically reduced. And yet I think her point is well taken. The affluent world, particularly the 1%, is more secure, whatever that means, right? what constitutes that security, more secure than ever in human history. And yet they suffer, I think, from a growing underlying anxiety. Even our wars are engineered toward zero risk to us. The suffering inflicted on them will henceforth be named collateral damage. She closes this chapter on zero risk in this way: peril must be faced head on. We can recover from pain, catastrophe, or grief, but evil will always claim a share. We will never be saved in advance. Actually, I misread. She said we can always recover from pain, catastrophe, or grief, but evil will always claim a share. And I'm not sure that always statement, these always statements are helpful. So I would like to rephrase this statement she just made in terms of Dharma. And this is how I would put it. Peril must be faced head on. There will be pain, catastrophe, and loss in human life. And the possibility of recovery. But greed, hatred, and delusion will only perpetuate suffering. We will never be saved in advance. We can only renew our vows to awaken for and with all beings. There is so much rich food for thought in this book. I'm just going to tempt you with a few of the chapter titles. I might have to do a sequel. In one, she talks about leaving the family, the risk of leaving the family, befriending our fears, the risk of being sad, the risk of being free, the risk of the unknown, the risk of being carnal, you know, living in a body. But for now, I'm going to skip to a chapter called Life, Mine, Yours. She writes, "What binds each of us to one another and to risk is our own lives. It is, as language says, to risk your life. But where does the possessive pronoun quietly slipped into this expression come from? What does it mean to say your life or my life? That is, your very own, instead of simply life, risking life. She says the risk of your life lies in the fact that it is absolutely singular and yet not your own. So this is that Zen paradox, isn't it? Of the simultaneous reality of the relative, the everyday, the world of distinctions, the world of yours and mine, and the absolute realm of oneness, no yours, no mine, interconnection. No separation. She writes, like any crushing experience, this life does not belong to us, and yet we alone have lived it and been transformed by it. In the end, she says, it will not have been, sorry, try that again. She says, it will have been life that risked us against death and with it, against attachments, loyalties, defenses, families, shame, and the burial of all memory, in an incandescence, a sadness, a dependence, a revolt, an imagination, a love, or a silence that remains unknown to us and yet found asylum within us. To say, I risk my life, is almost impossible. Only at rare moments do we coincide with ourselves to such an extent. But we must believe it possible to say, life was risked in him or her, or you or me. That is, as a witness, to recognize this risk in a painful fraternity, perhaps, but a true one. Do you see what she's saying? Maybe it's not so much a matter of risking your life or of recklessly courting death, so much as giving yourself fully to life. As it is, right here, right now, always changing. Paying attention to what hinders giving yourself to life. Self-clinging, aversion, fear, anxiety, agitation, dullness, depression, doubt. Those are the hindrances, right? And in shining the light of awareness on those hindrances, we see them as insubstantial. They start to kind of dissolve. We see them as subject to change and conditioning. And we release our grip on them, right? We let them go. And in releasing our grip on our self-identity in that way, we are then more able to bear witness to life. Life risking us, all of us, blundering human beings and all other beings, all our relations. As we try and keep on trying to find a way to live on this earth together with respect and care. So again and again and again, we vow to awaken for and with all beings. So let us do that together. Let's chant the Bodhisattva vows. May our intention equally extend to every being and place with the true merit of Buddha's way. Beings are numberless. I vow to save them. Delusions are inexhaustible. I vow to end them. Dharma gates are boundless. I vow to enter them. Buddha's way is unsurpassable. I vow to become it.